listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
After a two-month hiatus, the U.S. State Department held a press conference on Thursday. This one had a special guest, the newly appointed special representative for Venezuela, Elliot Abrams.
A few comments to start. 2 weeks ago, Juan Guaido and the democratically elected National Assembly took the courageous and constitutional step of declaring Guaido interim president and forming a transitional government while working toward free and fair elections. We, the United States, recognized Guaido as the interim president on January 23rd. As of today, 23 European countries have recognized Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. I believe we're up to 48 countries around the world that have recognized him. As many of you know, there are meetings yesterday and today in Uruguay about the crisis in Venezuela. One, an Uruguay and Mexico-led meeting, another, the International Contact Group on Venezuela. Instead of trying to accommodate Maduro through contact groups or dialogue, we urge countries to recognize Juan Guaido as interim president and join us in responding to his call for immediate international humanitarian assistance to meet the needs of the Venezuelan people. Maduro has proven he will manipulate any call for negotiations to his advantage, and he has often used so-called dialogues as a way to play for time. We urge all involved to deal solely with the legitimate Guaido government. The time for dialogue with Maduro has long passed. Every day that Maduro remains in power is a day where political prisoners remain in jail, detainees are abused, and Venezuelans go without food and medicine. The contrast between interim President Guaido and Maduro is striking. While Mr. Guaido calls for humanitarian assistance for the people of Venezuela. Excuse me. While Guaido calls for humanitarian assistance for the people of Venezuela, Maduro continues to block unhindered access to international humanitarian assistance and denies Venezuelans the basic necessities they direly need unless they declare loyalty to him. The U.S. government is coordinating with Guaido and his team of experts. Other governments in the region are humanitarian partners on the logistics of deploying aid to mobilize a response efficiently and safely. We are pre-positioning items, relief items, food, nutritional supplements, hygiene kits, medical kits in Colombia so that they are available to reach Venezuelans in need in their own country as soon as that is safe and logistically possible. Yesterday, Ambassador Carlos Vecchio announced an international conference on humanitarian assistance to take place at the OAS on February 14th to address the urgent humanitarian needs of the Venezuelan people. We encourage everyone, governments, organizations, private entities, to answer his call and support the long-suffering Venezuelan people. As Secretary Pompeo said, the U.S. will mobilize and transport humanitarian aid, medicine, medical supplies, surgical supplies, nutritional supplements for the people of Venezuela. I would like to state that we are imposing visa restrictions and revoking the visas of members of the illegitimate Constituent Assembly. This body has usurped many of the constitutional powers of the National Assembly, the legitimate National Assembly, and embodies Maduro's destruction of democratic institutions. While I cannot name names because visa information is protected, I can state that we will continue to take action against those destroying Venezuela's democratic institutions. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions.
Matt. Thanks, Robert. Just on the contact group, you mentioned at the beginning that 23 European countries now recognize Guaido, and yet the EU was the primary organizer of the contact group. So I'm wondering, one, if you guys were invited to join and said no for the reasons that you outlined, that time for dialogue has passed. And secondly, if 23 European countries have already de-recognized Maduro, how do you think that the contact group is dialogue?
I hope they're going to follow the position of the United States, which is that the only worthwhile message to the Maduro regime is it's time to end the dictatorship in Venezuela. The question is really, what is the purpose of the contact group? And we'll find out when they issue a final statement. But our messages to the members of the contact group have been, don't fall into a trap that Maduro has set many times before, where there's a phony dialogue rather than a strong message to him. It's time to go.
Right. But did you decline an opportunity to be part of the contact group?
I don't believe we were ever interested in joining the contact group because we don't think that's the way to go.
Mr. Abrams, can you talk about what the U.S. has in mind for Nicolas Maduro himself? John Bolton tweeted that he'd be happy to see him on a beach somewhere. Would you care where he goes? Would the U.S. seek to have him face justice of some sort? Do you have anything in mind for what the end game for him ought to be?
The end game for him should be to leave power, and the sooner the better, because his own situation is only going to decline the longer he clings to power, and the more misery there is in Venezuela.
Where would you like to see him go? Should he remain in Venezuela or leave the country?
I think it is better for the transition to democracy in Venezuela that he be outside the country. And there are a number of countries that I think would be willing to accept
him. Which ones?
Well, he's got friends in places like Cuba and Russia. And there are some other countries, actually, that have come to us privately and said they'd be willing to take members of the current illegitimate regime if it would help the transition.
Can you name any?
No.
Mr. Abrams. Hello. How are you?
You're in a democracy.
So, two questions. Quickly, you say time is long past to negotiate with Maduro, but this is a different situation in which you have an opposition leader that has come forward and that is willing, that has united the opposition, as you've claimed. Number two, how are you going to get the aid into Venezuela when Maduro still has the military behind him and he controls all of the territory?
It is probably correct that the Venezuelan army, if mobilized, could prevent international aid from reaching Venezuela. That would be a really tragic situation. And we are hopeful that that won't happen. We saw the blocking of the bridge in Cucuta. But members of the army are Venezuelan citizens. They have parents and children and brothers and sisters who are suffering badly. So our hope is that they will be able to persuade Maduro, or they will simply disobey orders to continue the starvation of the people of Venezuela. As to discussions with Maduro, negotiating with him on his departure is fine if we ever get to that negotiation. Obviously, he may flee someday, or he may seek to negotiate conditions. But that's not what he's done in the past. What he's done in the past is to use these negotiations to prolong his stay in power and to try to demonstrate his legitimacy. And that we're against.
Can you say that when did the administration become aware of Mr. Guaido, and how long has the administration been working with Mr. Guaido?
I can't actually answer that question because I've been here for too short a time. He was an elected member of the National Assembly, in one of the major parties in the Group of Four, leading Democratic parties. So I think it depends also who. If you ask me, for example, when did Ambassador Todd or when did now Chargé Story know of him, I'm sure they've known him a long time. Obviously, he's got a lot more famous recently.
And are you confident that he's been sufficiently vetted, especially as this has gone on now for the last year?
Yes, and I think... you know the pressure that he's under. You saw the incident that happened just a few days ago where police entered his own home, his apartment, where his 20-month-old daughter was. Think of the pressures that he's under. I think that the leadership that he is giving to the Venezuelan people is really quite extraordinary.
ABC. Mr. Abrams, you just in follow-up to something that you said to Leslie, you talked about you're hopeful that the Maduro regime wouldn't block aid coming across the border. Does that mean that you intend with your partner countries, perhaps with NGOs, to begin moving that aid without explicit permission to do so?
We will be moving aid to the border of Venezuela in the hope that, and there is some aid there now, in the hope that we will be able to get it in. I don't think that we or the Colombians or the Brazilians or anyone else is planning to try to force it in. It's an extraordinary situation if you think about it. You've seen the statistics about hunger, about the closure of hospitals, about the spread of communicable diseases that had been eradicated because now they cannot be vaccinations. There are dire needs. And I think many people, again, in the Venezuelan army feel those needs for themselves and their families. So we're hopeful that that, at least initial decision on the part of Maduro can be turned around if he sees a real demand on the part of the people of Venezuela. Let it in. That's all we're asking. Let it in.
Sir, you just mentioned the visa restriction, and is there any discussion on any sanction regarding the regimes or governments that continue to support and help Maduro regime and sabotaging the democratic transition. Separately, there is a perception in China and in other countries that U.S. is interfering in the domestic politics. What do you respond to those criticism? Thank you.
Well, there has been interference in the domestic politics of Venezuela for a long time, primarily by Cuba, which has a very large presence in Venezuela. If you look around at the now nearly 50 democracies that are supporting interim President Guaido and the National Assembly, it's hard really to say that all of those countries are engaged in some kind of joint effort to interfere. What we're trying to do is help Venezuelans create a system where, if you will, they can interfere in their own internal affairs, where their politics is in the hands of the Venezuelan people, where the future of their country can be determined by in a free election by the people of Venezuela.
How about the sanction against governments that support?
Well, the sanctions that exist now have been enacted are not secondary sanctions, they're primary sanctions. We will continue to speak to governments around the world, urging them to get on the right side of this issue, which is the side of supporting the people of Venezuela and leading toward a transition and a free election there. We will keep pushing.
I spoke with Ambassadors Tare and Vecchia this morning, and I asked them about this 30-day deadline. You know, in the Constitution, he was able to take power, but it says only for 30 days. And they're confident with the situation on the ground as it is that the public and the Constitution gives them time to fix this. But I'm wondering if there's any kind of concern as we pass that 30-day mark and the clock starts to tick down, if the Guaido government can't take control, if they start to lose momentum, that we could see this fall apart.
Well, I don't think so. First, I don't think they're going to lose momentum. They seem to be gaining momentum as more and more countries join this struggle to support the people of Venezuela. If it is true that at the end of 30 days it has not been possible to begin a transition to a free election and an elected democratic government, the fault will be that of the regime. So I doubt that it will have any repercussions on the National Assembly and Mr. Guaido.
But don't you think if there are two presidents of Venezuela, neither of whom...
There is only one president of Venezuela, and there is a former president of Venezuela.
All right, last question, Michelle, please.
Can I update on the U.S. diplomats in Venezuela, their security, their protection, and the U.S. presence in general?
As you've heard the Secretary say many times, that there's no greater priority for him, for the Department, than the safety of our officials on the ground around the world. That remains a concern. It gets a lot of attention here. And we're working on that, and I would not like to say much more about it because it's important to us.
That was the newly appointed U.S. State Department envoy on Venezuela, Elliot Abrams. It's the same Elliot Abrams who was convicted of two counts of unlawfully withholding information from Congress during the Iran-Contra affair back in the early 1990s. One voice that hasn't been heard much in the United States spoke out on the situation in Venezuela. That was President Nicolas Maduro. He spoke with RT earlier this week, and he began by addressing the recognition by a number of European governments of an opposition figure as the legitimate head of state of his country.
Yo creo que han cometido un error.
It's a political and diplomatic blunder. It's the wrong move. We're in the 21st century, and international relations can't rely on ultimatums in this day and age. You can't just tell others, you have 7 days to do this, and that's in my interests. If not, I'm going to invade you or do something else. It's a clear violation of international law, in particular the right to coexistence. I think it is a diplomatic, political, and ethical mistake that puts European governments in a bad light. They recognize something that does not exist. There is only one government in Venezuela, one that was elected through a direct vote as set forth in the Constitution, one that swore an oath of allegiance to the Constitution, and one that executes its functions and performs its duties. I am head of government. I am its servant. Whatever happens elsewhere is a coup, a joke, a comedy. It's a disgrace for some European governments to toe the reckless and extremist line imposed by Washington. It's all been designed at the White House. Washington has used diplomatic pressure to force its puppets in Latin America and dishonorable governments in Europe to pursue a policy that is doomed to fail, a policy that violates international law.
Which countries are you referring to?
I mean the members of the so-called Lima Group. They bow to the U.S. and stand in the way of integration of Latin American and Caribbean nations. It's an attempt, the first one in our history, to impose their own rules on us, to run our country from abroad and to inflict damage on our nation. As for Europe, their actions are simply outrageous.
You have condemned Pedro Sanchez.
I can't but condemn Pedro Sanchez because he is making the same grave mistake as José María Aznar, who agreed to support George Bush's invasion of Iraq and forever tainted his reputation with blood. He went down in history as an accomplice of the bloody war in Iraq. As a practicing Christian, I pray to God that our nation does not have to put up an armed resistance to U.S. troops. If that indeed happens, Pedro Sanchez will have blood on his hands forever.
Are you concerned about your own legacy? What do you think people will remember you for?
I do care about my legacy. There's one thing I know for sure. I will not be remembered as a traitor, as a weak man who reneged on his historical commitments and betrayed his nation. I do not know what happens next. It is vital for me to perform my duties here and now, to defend my homeland, to act against a military aggression and the threat of aggression against Venezuela by Donald Trump, and to maintain peace in this country.
What if there had been no ultimatums or pressure? What do you call an early presidential election of your own will?
The only upcoming election in Venezuela is the parliamentary election that is scheduled to take place, according to the Constitution, in 2020. I propose the National Assembly make arrangements for an early vote, and the issue is now being considered.
But no presidential election.
We just had a presidential election less than a year ago. They were held in full accordance with the Constitution. They were transparent, and there were international observers watching the vote. The problem of the opposition is not that we need another election. Elections are not rare in Venezuela. Over the last 20 years, we've held 25 elections. In the last 18 months, we had 6 elections. So there's no lack of elections in Venezuela. The 2018 election was held early because the opposition called for it. Throughout 2017, they were calling for it, and in December 2017, we told them we would do it.
But this situation is different now. You're facing a possible war since Trump is not ruling out military action, and neither are you. You announced the creation of 50,000 strong popular defense units. The situation is extremely tense. Are you afraid there will be war?
Venezuela no va a haber guerra ni intervención militar.
There will be no war or military intervention in Venezuela, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't get ready to fight for our land. We need to prepare our weapons, artillery, missile launchers. We need to prepare 2 million militia fighters. We're right now holding military exercises to mobilize the powerful National Bolivarian Armed Forces, National Bolivarian Military Aviation, Bolivarian Navy, and the National Guard. We're getting ready to defend our country, but we're also getting ready to combat unlawful threats coming from Donald Trump in violation of international law, i.e. the threat of a U.S. military intervention. This is just immoral. I use every media outlet to urge the entire world, heads of state, heads of government, world leaders, social movements, and the international community to denounce the absurd steps Donald Trump is taking against Venezuela and to stop him. He threatened us with a military intervention, but Venezuela has not surrendered and never will.
But is anyone listening to you?
Yo creo que se escucha.
I think so. The world is becoming increasingly sensible and conscious. Day by day, the aversion towards Donald Trump and his threats will be growing. The 21st century is not the time for cannon fire and military threats. No. The 21st century should be a century of dialogue, civilized behavior, politics, respect for diversity, peace, peaceful coexistence, and finding peaceful diplomatic solutions to international conflicts. Dialogue is the most important thing for Venezuela. It's our motto.
You're talking about dialogue. Meanwhile, your army is getting ready for a military action. No nation is ready for war, though. So here's the big question. How can this war be avoided?
We need to do it through spreading the truth and through peaceful diplomacy. The international community must step in. We need to ensure that a military intervention would cost the U.S. entirely too much in terms of military spending and human lives. What's the formal reason for this war? What's the casus belli, I'm asking you? Did I say it right?
Casus belli.
What's Donald Trump's casus belli against Venezuela? What is it? Do we have WMDs? Are we a threat to U.S. national security? Do you know what the casus belli is here? Venezuelan oil, Venezuela's resources, gold, natural gas, diamonds, ore, water, our material wealth. Part of the casus belli is our spiritual wealth, by which I mean the Bolivarian Revolution. The U.S. wants to destroy the legacy of the revolution that became a shining example of independence and social justice. The U.S. has no reason to threaten us. Donald Trump has to immediately take back all his military threats against the peaceful and noble people of Venezuela, Bolivar's people.
These are external threats, but there is a domestic conflict unfolding as well. What's the main threat it poses?
El interno se ha pretendido...
The domestic conflict boils down to a coup attempt in violation of our Constitution. There was an attempt to create another government that would function simultaneously, and it was doomed to fail. No new government exists. It only functions online with the support of satellite countries. There was an attempt to substitute a general election, which is the only legitimate way to become president in Venezuela, with declaring yourself leader in the city square with the support of social media and mass media. I genuinely believe in dialogue. I believe in it, and I hope that the initiative put forward by Mexico, Uruguay, Bolivia, and the 14 CARICOM countries can come to fruition, allowing Venezuela to create an environment for understanding, generosity, dialogue, and positive plans for the future.
And if in the course of this dialogue it was decided to hold a new election, would you agree to it?
The problem for us is not about having an election. It's all about our economy. The first thing we should agree on is that we demand the lifting of our economic, trade, and financial blockade. We should demand that resources which have been stolen from us be returned. This should be the first provision of the program for our country's long-term rehabilitation. As for the election, I would raise the question of granting legal status to the legislative power, the only one which hasn't had it in the recent years, and doing so ahead of time.
Are you willing to negotiate with Juan Guaido? If you do negotiate with him, will you recognize him as a legitimate player? Would you be willing to do so?
I believe that Juan Guaido is a pawn used by the opposition for a reckless scenario that is not destined to be implemented. I am, and I've always been, ready to negotiate. More than 300 times I've called for dialogue with all parties and different opposition leaders, which are more significant than this individual. I suggested sitting at the negotiating table with an open agenda and working out a peaceful solution for Venezuela in order to normalize the situation in our country.
But they refuse to sit at the negotiating table. Do you find yourself at crossroads now?
If they refuse, then things will go the way they've always gone in Venezuela. Peace will be established one way or another. Venezuela will continue going its own way. These military threats by the U.S. government against Venezuela can only galvanize public consensus that the country needs peace. If they follow U.S. government instructions and refuse to negotiate, it will not be to their advantage in the eyes of the public. According to polls, more than 80% of Venezuelans want to see negotiations and a peaceful resolution of the situation.
U.S. President Donald Trump doesn't intend to discuss anything either. Nonetheless, Mexico came up with an initiative. Do you think that Mexico, Russia, and China are playing a key role here? How can this crisis be resolved internationally?
I appreciate the diplomatic position of most governments calling for dialogue. I'm grateful to Vladimir Putin's government for its strong and clear position and for openly opposing any aggression aimed at Venezuela or a coup attempt. I am grateful to Chinese President Xi Jinping for his position, as well as to the President of Turkey and prime ministers and presidents of the whole world, particularly in Latin America. I support the initiative of Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, Uruguayan President Tabaré Vázquez, Bolivarian President Evo Morales, and prime ministers of 14 Caribbean community states, who will start a round of talks at a global peace conference on February 6th and 7th. All the parties involved in the Venezuelan conflict will meet there at much-needed negotiations. I believe in dialogue, in solving problems through mutual understanding. I believe in the power of words and in politics. I don't believe in war, violence, and military threats. You can rest assured, peace will prevail in Venezuela, and so will the word of peace. Whether they want it or not, peace will rule in Venezuela.
As for domestic policies, you're concerned about the economy.
Yes, I'm deeply concerned.
Let's talk about the economy. Hyperinflation is a serious concern. At the same time, there is no research or economic variables that you could use as a basis for a government plan to promote economic development. How do you plan to kickstart the economy?
Back in August, I launched an economic recovery program to spur growth and achieve prosperity. It features 11 key changes to reach equilibrium in taxes and finances and boost investment. There have been areas where we have succeeded and areas where we have failed, but overall, I believe it is the right plan. Today, our priority is to go back to growth, increase productivity and GDP. We also need to tackle those distortions causing hyperinflation, which spoils the lives of Venezuelans. We do have strong policies in place in such areas as social protection, labor, a safety net, national welfare, pensions, state education and medicine, housing, culture, and leisure. We are constantly revising salaries. No doubt hyperinflation caused by the illegal parallel market exchange rate has strongly damaged our economy. This is my concern right now, implementing a market economy action plan that has already yielded some good results. It's too early to call it a victory, but I believe in the success of our market policy. We seek to keep the criminal influence of the U.S. dollar in check and to make sure it does not have an impact on our fight against hyperinflation this year.
Can you please give some specific examples?
Today we work on two main tracks. First, our market. We have already succeeded in decreasing the criminal parallel exchange rate of the U.S. dollar. And now we are introducing new regulations to determine the real value of foreign currencies. Second, we're testing a fixed price system for food, which is meant to protect the market from the direct influence of exchange rates. This is an economic war we're in. We have increased production output in certain industries, but this is still the major issue for our nation. We have everything that is needed to ensure rapid economic recovery and accumulation of wealth, alongside with fostering the well-being of the country. It will allow us to bring Venezuela back to the high living standards and social welfare that we used to have.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Donald Trump's second State of the Union address was conspicuously light when it came to foreign policy. Why is this? Was his aim to avoid disappointing his base while at the same time wishing not to spar with the deep state? What are these mixed signals all about? Is it an elaborate strategy or an indication of indecisiveness? Crosstalking U.S. foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Brian Becker in Washington. He's the director of the Answer Coalition, as well as host of Loud and Clear, a daily news show on Radio Sputnik. Also in Washington, we have John Tsitsilidis. He is a geopolitical strategist at Trilogy Advisors. And in Auburn, we cross to Lou Rockwell. He is a political analyst at lourockwell.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Brian, let me go to you first. I'll just kind of throw my introduction at you again. Trump wasn't really heavy on the foreign policy, though I give him kudos. I thought it was a very conciliatory address, considering it came from Donald Trump. But let's stay with foreign policy. He didn't talk much about it. Is it because he didn't want to disappoint his base and he didn't want to spar with the deep state, which he's had a lot of problems with, even individuals very close to him in his own administration? And I'm talking specifically one instance like taking troops out of Syria and Afghanistan. What was your take? Go ahead, Brian.
Well, the foreign policy part of the speech came after, I think, an hour and 10 minutes. It was a long speech. It was like an hour and 24 minutes. So, it was stocked at the end with foreign policy issues that had to do with Syria, had to do with Afghanistan, had to do with Korea, Iran, Russia. Important big issues. But again, as you said, Peter, they came very towards the end of the speech and not too long on it. I think the Soto speech, the State of the Union address, was basically the kickoff of Donald Trump's 2020 election campaign. This election will not be decided on foreign policy issues. And as a consequence, he focused on two things. He focused on immigration, because that's the play to his political base. And also, he's trying to present the Democratic Party as socialist, which is kind of silly, but may work as a political electoral device, because it's the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party that could actually defeat Donald Trump, competing with him for some of the same voters. So he's trying to ostracize socialism. He resolved that America will never become a socialist country, which I don't think any president in recent history has said to the American people, we reject the road of socialism. It wasn't really on the table. But nonetheless, I think parts of the foreign policy speech were significant. He said the U.S. is leaving Syria. He wrongly claimed credit for the defeat of ISIS. That wasn't the American presence. He said the U.S. was going to negotiate with the Taliban. He spoke positively about the Taliban's desire for peace. That shows a desire on the Trump White House, on the part of the Trump White House, to actually end the war. In the case of Venezuela, he's like, I'm naming the new president of Venezuela. Of course, the U.S. government does not have that right. Well, that's not how it works. And in the case of Korea,
all I can say is bad habits die hard.
In the case of Korea, indeed. I mean, that's the part of the continuity of the Trump administration. American presidents have been overthrowing other sovereign governments for a very long time. That's not something new.
Okay. John, let me go to you. Let me quote President Trump a few lines from his address here. Foolish wars, politics, and ridiculous partisan investigations are the only obstacles to the miracle of American economic growth. And he went on to say, if there's going to be peace and legislation, there must not be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way. I find that you are kind of a mixed salad of a lot of different things simultaneously at the same time. Go ahead, John.
Well, I think one of the reasons why the president kept a foreign policy and national security aspects of the speech towards the latter part is because the astonishing success of his economic policies have largely gone unmentioned in U.S. media that's been focused on a whole host of so-called scandalous activity, none of which has come to fruition and which really doesn't exist. And so he's taken the time to remind or to inform most Americans that, in fact, the economy is red hot, as he described it. We have record low unemployment, not only on a national level, but for important constituencies that have suffered from high unemployment or from high, from high unemployment in prior years. And also the fact that this is really a middle class and working class issue for the American people. And I think he really wanted to emphasize that more than anything else. So this is where I think the priority is. And most American voters, as most voters in most countries around the world, care primarily about their standard of living, about their quality of life. Yes, they want to know that their country is safe from enemies abroad and close to home. And that's why I think it was prioritized the way that it was. But the bulk of this is going to be on what the president is trying to do and what he has accomplished and will try to continue to accomplish, and to minimize a lot of these distractions that the media here has largely focused on, but have kept many voters uninformed about the tremendous economic progress of the last 2 years.
Well, John, I absolutely agree with you on that. I mean, the reporting, it's almost non-existent, okay? But let me go to Auburn Liu. I still want to stay with the foreign policy thing here, because I think it was intentional, because Trump has found himself in a lot of hot water with people very, very close with him, contradicting him, interpreting his words, shifting policy. Syria is the perfect example. At the end of December, we're getting out of Syria, and then you have Pompeo and Bolton going on Middle East tours saying, well, it's not really exactly what he means. He kind of means this or that. I mean, basically putting words in the president's mouth. And the reason why I mention this, because there is a part of his base that want these foreign wars to come to an end. And he's trying to honor that while at the same time meddling in the affairs of Venezuela in the most obtrusive and, amazingly transparent way. This is a coup that is being just advertised in broad daylight. Go ahead, Lou in Auburn.
Well, you know, when it comes to Syria, yes, he's said he's going to get the troops out. But when he was at the AIPAC meeting in Washington, he said, I'm not going to get the troops out. They need to be there to protect Israel from Iran. Of course, a nonsensical statement.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. Even his statement about great nations don't fight endless wars, as he examined Rome or Britain or, for that matter, American history. But one very interesting thing, when the cameras panned to the generals after he made that comment, they were looking at him with pure hate. So I thought if he had any brains, he would get rid of these generals and promote more pro-peace guys, or at least non-warmongering guys from lower in the ranks, because these generals, with their gigantic number of decorations, I guess self-awarded decorations, hate his guts. They hate the idea of peace. They hate the idea of any kind of detente with anybody. And as long as they're there, seems to me that's a huge problem for him. Not only Bolton, not only the civilian people in the White House, but the military people, too.
Okay, you know, Brian, the interesting thing is you know, when we mentioned Bolton and Pompeo, okay, I think it's quite clear that they're interventionists to the core, have a very deep and abiding respect for American exceptionalism. But Donald Trump is America first. And can they coexist? Can they work together? Because the more you think about it, the more they're very contradictory. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, well, you see, in the case of Korea, let's turn to Korea, for instance. I mean, Donald Trump is personally committed, I believe, to coming up with a peace deal with the DPRK, and he set the second summit. If it wasn't for Trump himself, and I'm not a fan of Trump, but if it wasn't for Trump himself, this process would not be going forward, because it's not just Bolton, it's the entire political establishment here in Washington, Democrat and Republican and the military, that's actually against a peace deal in Korea. They prefer the status quo. It provides a pretext for endless spending. It's not just endless war, but endless spending of American tax dollars on military things. And of course, it projects American power into South Korea in a very direct way with 30,000 U.S. troops that continue to occupy the country. Trump wants this deal, though. Now, Bolton has tried to sabotage it. He said in the beginning, remember, he said, well, Libya should be the model for the DPRK. And the DPRK is like, what? That ended up with the execution of the head of state. So then the DPRK canceled the next meetings. I think then Trump intervened and said, look, we're going to actually go along with the DPRK posture on negotiations, which means denuclearization comes as a process, as a step-by-step negotiating pattern, and that while North Korea offers concessions, the U.S. must do the same. There must be a process leading to, first, the normalization of relations, the end of the Korean War, and then the talk about real denuclearization. You can't ask North Korea to disarm and at the same time refuse to end the war from 1950 to 53. Nobody disarms when a war is still happening. The only way you start to reduce weapons is if you say peace is coming. And Trump appears to have accepted this notion, which I think is key to having a changed relationship on the Korean Peninsula between the two Koreas and between the U.S. and North Korea.
John, reflect upon that there, because does his foreign policy team, and we'll use the example of the Korean Peninsula, do they want their own president to succeed?
First of all, let me just offer a different premise for this larger discussion, if I might, Peter.
Go ahead.
The reason that countries such as China and Russia and Iran, countries that are opposed to U.S. national interests on a global scale, have been able to prosper over the last 25 to 30 years is at the U.S. taxpayer expense for a Navy that's provided open shipping lanes for commerce, for trade, for relations under a rules-based order that seems to be upended by a number of powers around the world.
Okay.
And so, there are criticisms to be had.
That's rules-based. That's rules-based.
Yes.
The destruction of Libya.
Yes,
that's
right.
Rules-based.
We'll talk about Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Eastern Ukraine as well.
Presence in Syria. These are correct international norms. I'm sorry, that doesn't make any sense.
We can devote hours to each of these issues. All I want to present is a different premise than what your other panelists have. That's all, for the way the international order has been able to prosper, including for countries that remain adamantly opposed to U.S. national interests. So just want to put that out there for the record.
Okay, I have to go to a hard break here. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on U.S. foreign policy. Stay with our team.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to John in Washington. I want to reiterate that I do agree with you what you said. You know, we could have very long discussions on the nature of the international order, but I would like to focus on Trump's foreign policy and the obstacles he faces, mm-hmm. because I think there's no doubt. You know, you have both houses of Congress passing non-binding resolutions, but very public that they do not want the president to have his own foreign policy and hemming him in all the way around. Now, I don't like all of those ideas, but there are certain prerogatives the president has, and traditionally anyway, and there's a good part or some part of his political base that supports it. That's why they voted for him. So it seems to me there's an unprecedented move to box in a president, not to move towards peace. Go ahead, John.
That's a very important point that you raised, Peter. And look, there's a healthy debate inside the Republican Party about how activist the foreign policy of the United States should be. And there are many people, unfortunately for them today in Washington, D.C., Republicans who are known as Never Trumpers, about 150 or so, who signed the famous letter in March of 2016 denouncing then-candidate Donald Trump as a potential president of the United States. And they're all outside the box now, with really no role to play directly in the formulation of U.S. foreign policy. But the debate is taking place between the White House and the Senate and House leadership. But I think more importantly, among the American people, many of whom are tired, as the president stated, of endless wars. The president's a businessman. He's not a typical politician. In his mind, you start a project and you finish it. You don't just have it going on continuously if there's no end in sight. However, he is very clear that he is going to be maintaining a presence in the Middle East, not so much for Israel alone, but really because the U.S. considers Iran to be a major national security threat. So even when there's a healthy debate about Syria and Afghanistan, there's very little debate about the Trump administration's policies against Iran.
Okay. So, Lou, what is the national security risk that the United States faces from Iran? Because I hear it all the time, but no one has ever given me any evidence. Give me some evidence. Go ahead.
It's justifying imperialism. It's just baloney. Iran is a small, poor country. They've got a lot of people, but economically they're small. They're militarily small, but Israel wants to destroy them. This is what this is why Trump is keeping his troops in Syria. So we said at AIPAC. So I think Iran is no threat to anybody. Poor Iran. I mean, they invaded anybody recently? I mean, this is unlike the U.S. They're not an aggressive power. The U.S., of course, invades all over the world. How many millions of people, by the way, has the U.S. killed over all the centuries? And it's all its wars, its occupations, its invasions. It's horrific. And we're supposed to believe that the U.S., of course, is maintaining an international rules-based order just out of the goodness of its heart, not because it, and of course, that's why it should be in control of the South China Sea and every other place in the every other water. Piece of water in the world. So this is just propaganda. Some of us thought that President Trump would be a different kind of president. I'd love to see it. I hope he actually takes the troops out of Syria. Hope he makes peace in Afghanistan and gets the heck out of there and stops killing people there. I hope he gets out of Iraq, although, of course, Israel doesn't want him getting out of Iraq. And they want to also not want him to get out of Syria because they want to keep control of the Golan Heights without any problem. So I'm afraid that the fact that he owes so much to Sheldon Adelson and other huge donors of his means maybe he's not going to do this. As to the Never Trumpers, he told us he would never have these sorts of people in his administration. There they are. They're all over the place. So is he weak? Is he actually a phony? I don't know. Yeah. I'd love to see him do something. He is the president. He can actually tell the military to get out of Syria. He can tell them to get out of Afghanistan. And the only negotiation he needs is to ask the Taliban, don't harry our troops as we move out, which they would be happy to agree to. Same in Syria. So, and also, of course, South Korea would like us out of South Korea.
Yep.
They don't. Many South Korean prime ministers have not wanted the U.S. in South Korea. The present one doesn't want us here. U.S. works very hard to keep that from happening, wants to occupy South Korea, and it's very expensive, terrible. It's a terrible thing. U.S. should get out of South Korea and let South Korea and North Korea negotiate their own deal.
Work it out themselves. And they're actually doing that.
That's exactly right.
Brian, what was your reaction to Elliot Abrams being made point man for Venezuela? I mean, I'm glad I wasn't sitting on a tall bar stool because I probably would have hurt myself because I was astounded, stunned. What was your reaction?
Well, Elliot Abrams' appointment was a clear signal from the Trump administration and from Bolton, and they all go back a long time. I mean, Elliot Abrams is a convicted felon. He lied to Congress. He violated U.S. laws to maintain the Iran-Contra arms sales to counter-revolutionary Somoza National Guardsmen who functioned as the security forces for the Somoza dictatorship before the revolution in 79. Elliot Abrams has been carrying out and exercising regime change options in Latin America. He's a main primary hawk to overthrow the Cuban government. You had John Bolton at the same time talking about the troika of tyranny, reminding us of Ronald Reagan's axis. The evil empire and George W. Bush's axis of evil in 2000 before the invasion of Iraq. Elliot Abrams is a clear signal that the U.S. is probably going to go to war against Venezuela, especially if their coup plans don't work out. I believe that's what's on the agenda. Elliot Abrams is there for one purpose and one purpose alone, and that's to initiate a confrontation with Venezuela. That's very dangerous. Even though the Venezuelan government is mired in a profound economic crisis and facing enormous economic sanctions, the people of Venezuela, including many people in the opposition, don't fancy a war. They don't fancy the United States dictating who their government's going to be. They don't look kindly at the right-wing Colombian government with its paramilitaries beginning to carrying out skirmishing activities, which will be a pretext at the border. That's very, very serious. This could blow up in the United States. Mexico, Uruguay, Bolivia, of course, Cuba are standing with Venezuela. The Lima Group is basically functioning as a proxy or as an extension of American power. Again, the U.S. has no legal right to carry out the overthrow of a sovereign government. When Venezuela has elections and the opposition wins, the government recognizes that. When the government wins, which is more frequently, the opposition always says it's fraud and becomes a pretext then for U.S. intervention.
Or they just don't participate. John, I mean, if there's an impending intervention into Venezuela, would it be wise to ponder the interventions of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of Syria, of Libya, overthrowing the legal government in Ukraine? It didn't work out too well for half of the country, at least here. I mean, is there ever any introspection, or is it? Do they think that, you know, this time it will be different? How many times can you say that and think it might happen? Go ahead, John.
I don't envision any type of military intervention in the crisis in Venezuela. As a matter of fact, your other panelists mentioned the Lima Group. It's unfortunate that he denigrated the good diplomatic efforts of many Latin American countries to try to achieve a peaceful resolution of the crisis in Venezuela. And the United States is working with most of its Latin American allies and now with key European Union countries to try to see if there's a peaceful transition away from, unfortunately, for the panelists, a fraudulent government under Nicolas
Maduro. While sanctioning them, how is that moving a peace process?
But
how does that move a peace process? When you have sanctions and you threaten even more sanctions. Go ahead.
May I finish?
And you also threaten military action.
Let John finish. Trump is saying all options
are on the table.
Okay, let John finish. Go ahead, John.
When a democratic process is approved by Cuba, I think we have to question whether or not that process is truly democratic. So let's just put things in proper diplomatic and political context here. I think the U.S. is very much concerned about a tremendous spillover into countries in Latin America with potentially 3 million or so Venezuelan refugees on top of the refugees that have already fled, the utter destitution of the country that has been so poorly and corruptly and fraudulently governed by Maduro.
Make the situation even worse. And the more sanctions, the worse it is. Okay, I'm not going to be an apologist for the government's economic planning. I think they've made a lot of mistakes. Okay, and corruption is also there. I mean, when you're sanctioning a country, you're intentionally hurting the average person because you know as well as everyone else watching this program, sanctions don't really hurt the elites. It hurts the average person. And how many times? In recent memory, at least, I can't think of one where the people rose up, okay, because of that. No, they usually hunker down. And that's when it gets dangerous. And that's where everything is on the table still. So can you explain to me how this tried and over again strategy ever works? Because it doesn't. Go ahead, John.
On a case-by-case basis, there's always a healthy debate to be had as to whether or not sanctions are going to be effective based on the conditions in that particular country. In Venezuela, my own sense is the reason that the Trump administration, and in many ways from a bipartisan consensus, is taking the sanctions approach is to ensure that the people of Venezuela know that the United States is not enabling the regime of Nicolas Maduro to continue to govern that country fraudulently and corruptly.
Okay,
by starving them.
I don't understand anything.
Their own government is starving them. Their own government is starving them. Let's be honest over here.
They make sure there's no food, there's no medicine.
Just the way.
Okay, I'm going to go to Lou. We have 45 seconds. I want Lou to have the last word here. Please, let me let Lou have the last word here. Lou,
of course, the U.S. ever since President Monroe.
Maybe the Venezuelan government should recognize the yellow vests. To become president of France. I think, you know, given the precedent the United States has set for Venezuela, why not?
Well, I myself would like to see the Yellow Vest take over France, but that's a separate topic. But of course, the U.S., ever since President Monroe has asserted control over Latin America, it controls it. And this is only the beginning, by the way. There are a lot of other countries in Latin America, the U.S. would like to overthrow their governments. The U.S. is always overthrowing governments. And one of its tools is, of course, allegedly sanctions. But the sanctions, again, yes, you're exactly right. They hurt regular people. I think that these people like Elliot Abrams enjoy hurting people. They enjoy starving people, just like the generals enjoy killing people.
Okay,
these are very unfortunate people.
Gentlemen, we've run out of time here. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Auburn. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.